Come on. That's exactly what you were thinking when you got up this morning. You said, don't miss Bellingham Covenant because we're talking about Lewis and Clark. So I know the juices in all the public school teachers, Christian school teachers in the building right now are all excited because this just reminds you of something that you probably taught recently. Is this working? Ryan? Do a double check here just to make sure. Are we good? Okay. So today is part one of a mini-series that I'm just going to do. It's a two-parter. But I have been nerding out on Lewis and Clark. I've been going back to my youth, going back to those history lessons of high school and middle school and even probably grade school, because this is a true historical part of our nation's history that is worth telling. And I hope as we go through these next two Sundays, you will also be inspired to both look at this story in our history, but also look at it through the lens of the purpose of God's church in our day and age. So, to set the stage for it, as any good class would do, I'm going to ask you to turn to one of your neighbors in twos or threes, and would you share the fun facts that you know about Lewis and Clark? You cannot use your cell phones. There is no Googling of the facts. You must go strictly from your own education on these issues. Go! Turn to each other. Share those facts. I have to interrupt real quick. I know he's just blabbing your ear off on facts that he knows. But I've been holding something in secret that I learned in Detroit in talking to. Well, that, yes, which is very exciting. And I was excited to meet him for the first time. But there's something related to you. Is that still secret? Oh. You got the job.
I have to leave tomorrow.
Tomorrow, she's heading back.
I was so fired up. I gave a quick reference. I said she may not list me, but
she's the Colleen now.
Oh, I'm so excited, Beth. I'm excited to talk to you more about that.
Okay. Talk about membership programs and how to make one.
Awesome. Love to.
And I shared with Rob the missional markers.
Yeah.
He wants to know more about that.
Awesome. I'm going to come over because he just seems like a guy that I'd really connect with. So I'm so happy for you, Beth. That's cool. Okay. I can see that Eric Sellerite, the Ling Blooms, all of our school teachers are just wowing their sections with their knowledge. Rick, you know it all. You're telling everybody. All our teachers, the DeHaunts, are sharing their knowledge. So let's just start with what were the first name? Who's got the first? Raise your hand. Anybody got the names, the first name? We got Lewis and Clark, but what were the first names? Right here.
William Clark and Meriwether Lewis.
Exactly right. Well done. Well done, Mr. Brewer. All right, what was the name of one of the unusual people that was along for this expedition? Oh, we're going to somebody else. Yeah, Sacagawea. Now, just a little point of reference that I learned, because I've been nerding out on this stuff. By the way, there's a great PBS special on this that Ken Burns did. And the one we're going to see a clip later from National Geographic. But Sacagawea is apparently the way that it's supposed to be pronounced. So take it for what it's worth. There you go. But very good. Yeah, an Indian woman, a native woman, Shoshone Indian, that was on this trip. Well, let's take a look. There they are, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. both in the United States Army, both commissioned by what president? What president was the one that commissioned this expedition? Thomas Jefferson in the back. Yes, the community college is now being heard from. Awesome. We're covering the bases here today. President Thomas Jefferson was the one who gave the orders to send the expedition out. And these two men, of course, leading the charge. Well, these are bonus points now. What was the name of the expedition that was given by President Jefferson? What was the name? What was that? Core Discovery. Now we're talking about seniors and adult day health. They're chiming in. Awesome. I love this term. And you are going to hear me use this not just in the next 2 weeks, but in the months to come. I love the idea of this whole name that was given to these adventurers. This was an especially established unit of the U.S. Army. This was not just a marketing ploy to sell books or get people excited about this. This was established by the U.S. Army. Now, we've established the time period, 1805, is when Jefferson was president and when this began. But what was the large land mass that was incorporated into the United States that precipitated this whole activity? Louisiana Purchase. We're hearing from Chicago now, from Chicagoland. Awesome. Good job. The Louisiana Purchase. So here's your map for you geography folks. And you can see that the expedition started in St. Louis and went up the waters of the Missouri, which had been explored to some extent. And then you can see it gets a little interesting up in Montana and into Idaho and our own state. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But Napoleon Bonaparte was needing some money for France. And fortunately, Jefferson was ready with cold cash to purchase the Louisiana Purchase. And so part of the expedition was to explore this part of what is now our country. And it was not only exploratory, but it was also diplomatic. Because Lewis and Clark were sent to begin to tell folks, guess what? You are now under the rule of this fledgling country called the United States. They were making a claim for this land. I've already shared the one river. What was the second river? The Missouri and the Columbia. Who said that over here? There you go. Steve Hiller. All right. The engineers are chiming in. The Missouri and the Columbia are the two rivers. Now, go to the next graphic. This was the first major challenge for the group. They had gone upstream in the first year and on the Missouri. Now, they're going against the current, right? Because the Missouri is running on the other side of the Continental Divide. It is running eastward. So their whole journey, the first summer, they wintered in North Dakota at Fort Mandan. And they began with 59 people in the Corps and one dog. I think it was Meriwether Lewis's dog. 59 people, but after the first winter in North Dakota, they were reduced to 33 people. One winter in North Dakota, and Bob Craft even moved out of there to come to the Northwest. So you were smart. You kept going west. But that was the first ferreting out of this Corps. All the adventure, all the hopes, and all the dreams about what this would mean came to a harsh reality as they spent that first winter in North Dakota. So they leave from there in the springtime. They're continuing to canoe upriver, and they hit this next photo, which is Great Falls, Montana. They did not have maps that showed these falls. In fact, there were, along the way, they were engaging with the native populations of our country, but the natives had told them that there was only one small falls that they were going to have to portage. It turned out that the Great Falls at that time, there were five separate falls that spread out over a 12-mile stretch. So the first challenge for this Corps of Discovery was to portage their way. And it took over a month to portage through those five falls and through this 12-mile stretch. And there they are, hauling canoes off the river and trying to get around the falls. So over a month has passed now, but they're still hopeful. This was a challenge, but it wasn't overly daunting to the fact that they would turn back and say, no more. But this is what was going to happen next and become their greatest challenge.
They had lost almost a month at the falls, and they needed to find the Shoshone and obtain horses before the cold weather set in. Sagagawea now recognized places from her youth and could help guide the men, but the Shoshone remained elusive. Finally, Lewis set out with a scouting party to search for them.
If we do not find them, I fear the successful issue of our voyage will be very doubtful.
Clark and the rest of the men labored on through frigid water that was barely passable. They planned to reunite further upriver once Lewis had found the Shoshone. Somewhere was the Missouri's source. From there, the men hoped for a quick mountain crossing and then an easy ride downstream to the Pacific Ocean. Ahead of the boats, Lewis made an historic discovery.
I had accomplished one of those great objects on which my mind has been unalterably fixed for many years.
The source of the great Missouri River had finally been found. From the Continental Divide above, Lewis hoped to see a river heading westward toward the ocean. Instead, he confronted a scene of crushing disappointment.
I discovered immense ranges of high mountains still to the west of us, with their tops partially covered with snow.
The need for horses was now more important than ever.
So you're saying, why didn't he just pull out his cell phone and get on Google Earth and figure out a way to get around all that? It's amazing to try and put ourselves back into that era and realize how primitive it was. But there were three main assumptions that the Corps of Discovery was going under, really provided by the great scientist himself, Thomas Jefferson. My wife and I were at Monticello just in April and had a chance to see his interest in science. But 300 years of experts on geography were wrong. They thought there was a navigable river that ran from the Missouri to the Pacific. oh, there might be a little bump or two. But really, everyone assumed that this was a waterway to the Pacific. They had explored this side of the country that we are privileged to live on. Ships had come on the Pacific, and they knew what lay over here, but no white man had explored the middle. So that was their first assumption that was false. The second was that the geography on the west side of our country would be the same as on the east. If you know your history, you know that most of our early history was all on the east coast, going back to the colonial times. And they just assumed the geography would extend in similar ways. And as we Westerners know, it gets crazy once you get into the Rocky Mountains and continue on west. And viewing the Rocky Mountains didn't compute to their scientific minds because they had no understanding of these mountains, no awareness. Even the native peoples had not warned them about it. And so many historians call this the adapt or die moment for the Corps of Discovery. Adapt or die. They had already gone from 59 down to 33. How many more would say, I didn't sign up for hauling things through the mountains. I don't want to die in a winter up in the Rockies. And by now, it's the end of July, and they were up in the snow of the Rockies. They had no idea what seasonally would happen. If there is snow in July, what will it be like in September and October? And so I'm going to pause the story right there. We'll pick it up next week. But winter was coming, and they needed to make decisions quickly. They could study this all they wanted and rationalize it, but what they were facing was a new reality that they were unprepared for. They had some skill set, of course. These were mountain men who had done travel in parts of the West, but they were completely unprepared for what faced them in the Rocky Mountains. There is a book that I read back in January. It's called Canoeing the Mountains. Todd Bolzinger is a Presbyterian pastor. Tim, I don't know if you're familiar, but was at San Clemente Presbyterian. Now he's at Fuller Theological Seminary in Los Angeles. But he wrote this book on Christian leadership in uncharted territory is the subtitle to it. And our denomination has given this book out to all of our pastors and leaders. And when I got together with four other covenant pastors back in January, as we were doing some personal planning together, we looked at this book. And it continues to resonate for me. I love the metaphor that Bolzinger uses for the times that we are living in. It can be applied on so many levels. He applies it to Christian leadership. But it is also applicable to the changing times in which the Church of Jesus Christ finds itself. Most of us who have been around the Christian Church over the last 50 years, if you're my age or older, I'm 63, by the way, but they point to decline in especially the mainline Protestant denominations of the Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, etc. There's been very observable decline in the mainline churches. But even amongst evangelical churches that have been growing during that period, there is a time for us to have deep reflection and prayerful planning about what might be next for God's church. It's not a time to panic. As I've told you many, many times, God's church has survived every kind of challenge through human history. But this is our challenge for the time in which we live and the time in which we are a part of God's bigger family and what Christ is doing on this earth. In addition to the changes that we're seeing amongst Western Protestant churches, we're also watching Western culture that is changing at an even more dramatic pace. Now, we can all go back and say, well, gee, my grandma had butter churns on the farm when she was growing up. And she had a spinning dryer that was hand cranked. That generation lived through many, many changes. Coming of the automobile, etc. I don't deny that. But I think if you read anything from sociologists, technical folks, business people, the pace of what we're experiencing in our lifetime, especially over the last 20 years, is unique. Just take the internet alone, which is sometimes compared to the coming of the Gutenberg press and the radical change that that caused as books were now available back in Reformation times. I got my first smartphone in 2009. I've had that sucker now. And am watching how that has impacted my life in ways that I never could have predicted. And I see it all around me. And now sociologists are wondering, what will the impact of that little handheld device be on our human interaction, as we could all give examples of how we see that everywhere we go. How about commerce? The changes in commerce. The retail landscape is changing at a breakneck speed. I'm so thankful I didn't go into bookstores or selling music or office supplies or industries that are gone because of the internet. And now we face a new day where we're seeing the grocery business and the food that we eat could be radically, drastically changed by Amazon's purchase of something like Whole Foods. What about the moral compass of the West, where we've seen a shift that the compass of morality is often determined by majority opinion rather than a foundational belief that there is a true moral fabric? And so we put our fingers into the wind and we can ask. We could ask on the internet on any moral issue and get a majority opinion, and that could be the law of the land. Because we took a poll, and this is what people think about that issue. These are seismic shifts. And on top of that, I lay the social problems that have been with us since all of time. But how is it in a booming Northwest economy, we have more businesses and more wealth in the Seattle to Vancouver to Portland corridor than we've ever had in my lifetime, or in history, really. But we can't solve our social problems. In fact, they visibly seem to be increasing as we look at the loss of a middle class, at poverty that is systemic, and homelessness and mentally ill that are on the streets. The times, they are a-changing. And I would add to it, you don't need to say this out loud, but what is the thing in your own personal world that is stirring that lets you know that we are in different times? What is it when you have your quietest moments, you go, the world has changed? And you can be 20 years old, you can be 15, and you can still feel that. This isn't just for those of us who have lived over the last 60-plus years. There's a sociological term for this change, for this accelerating world dynamic. You can use this at a party to impress your friends. VUCA. Yeah, just kind of throw that out there and let that resonate. Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. If you want a definition for what you feel sometimes, after you go through a day and you see the unsettledness, or something just caught you by surprise, the Rocky Mountains that you came up against, you got VUCA'd. It's probably what happened. This is what Todd Bolsinger says in the book. He describes, do you have that one, Elliot? There we go. He's talking now about the Christian church. In our era, Todd would be my age. As pastors, we were trained to teach those who come on their own to church, to care for those who call for help in our church, to lead those who volunteer and to administer the resources of those who willingly give and participate. That's the definition of what many call the Christendom that we grew up in this past 50 years in America. But now we are being called to minister to a passing parade of people who treat us like we are but one option in their personal salad bar of self-fulfillment. I've certainly felt those changes, being one who's been privileged to be in leadership over this era. There's a theologian from Princeton, Daryl Guder, also writes a lot on mission for churches, and he says this in a positive sense. Missional churches are those that understand the church as fundamentally and comprehensively defined by its calling and its sending, its purpose to serve God's healing purposes for all the world as God's witnessing people to all the world. Much of the missional language that we've been using over the last 3 years as we've talked about the Vitality Pathway is exactly that.